Welcome to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast with your hosts, Richard Hill and Matthew Darlitz.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. My name is Matthew Darlitz, and I'm here with my wonderful curator of everything interesting on the Science of Psychotherapy, Richard Hill. How are you, Richard?
Look, I'm feeling very curated. And curating. No, it's a great thing. It's an interesting term, and we use that this week. As we know, I'm the managing editor, which is that beautiful term. But it is. It's a gathering in, and information comes to us, and we'll see this as we talk about the magazine. There's a bit of information, a nice article that's been around for months, and just needed its place, and now it found it, and the author's very pleased that it found an appropriate space. Because that's what we're going to talk about today.
Let's talk about the magazine. So what have we got up first, Richard?
I love some of the stuff we've got. We've got a follow-up of work with Fabio Sinibaldi, our wonderful friend in Italy. Now, he's got a great article that follows through his Switch stuff that we would have in the Switch book.
Now, we had Fabio on the show just not too long ago talking about some of his theories, and it was so... It's really good to have this in the magazine right now. And I got really excited about some of the graphics, something as simple as the graphics, some of the graphics that he's done to illustrate this switch theory that he has. I've printed out for myself the five switches that he describes in this story in our magazine. And so when you go through, he's categorized these different areas of core system regulation, adaptation, social, and something he calls flows. And within each of these domains, there are things like neuroplasticity, epigenetics, basic physiology, inflammation. And this reminded me of John Arden Seed's acronym that he uses to form a framework. And what I see Fabio do here is give us a really wonderful framework, which is maybe a little bit more extended than the Seed's acronym. But there's certainly... there's a richness here that we can use as a framework with our clients, basically as a checklist. And he describes in the article how he uses this as a checklist to go through and just see what elements are going on with our client when we're talking to them about, you know, their metabolism, about what's going on with their neural networks, you know, with schemas, with their window of tolerance, with all of these sort of things. And then what is happening with the flow? And when he talks about flow, that reminds me of consistency, you know, congruence or incongruence within our neural networks.
Yeah, and this is what's lovely about what he does, because he gives physical activities. He engages integrates physical activities that enable some of these processes to continue successfully. I mean, things like we know vagal tone is terribly important for improving some of these aspects. And so he shows different forms of breathing patterns that, and things that I've not seen before. He's taken things to additional levels of thought and process. So Fabio's got great. So he got some case studies in there, so we can really get our hands around the thinking patterns, the activity patterns. So that's what makes this article particularly valuable to read, and to take these very practical applications. And then, of course, if you get excited by the article, then, you know, we've got the book there that you can access. But we've also got a book coming out in October by this really fabulous guy. We're going to be talking to Dr. Oliver Morgan in a podcast coming up soon. But and he calls himself Ollie, which I shouldn't be so familiar because I haven't met him yet. But he's in his 70s, he's great, his doctor's been around, and we've got this chapter, his new chapter on his book, Addiction, Attachment, Trauma and Recovery. He's a guy that's been there, seen it, knows it, and it shares this this program and this this understanding with us.
Yes, and he really lays the groundwork very well, and so this is a good recap of attachment theory. So he takes us through attachment theory, and it was good for me to, you know, to get a refresh on all of that. Now, we've only got part one in this issue this month. We'll do part two next month. It's quite a long article.
Yeah, it's a long chapter. There's a lot to take up. We're thinking of doing the whole thing in one go, but I think it's better to we decided, as a curator, I decided better to have that thinking. Because what's important is the framework of how he brings in the framework of trauma. This thing that disconnects us, this thing that creates stuckness, creates the inability to engage. And of course, this inability to engage, the lack of relationalism, is what people have been talking about as one of the fundamental aspects of addiction. Now, it's been really had a lot of talk in the last few years. So I love that. I'm really looking forward to talking with Dr. Morgan. I think it'll be really interesting to hear just someone who's been there and seen it a million times.
Yes. And he's written this at a very nice level of understanding, so he doesn't get too technical. We are talking about the neurobiological, you know, satisfaction of attachment needs through addictive behavior. But, you know, he handles that in a way which is at a very nice level of understanding. You know, he doesn't get too scientific, but yet scientific enough that we can understand, you know, that this is a real thing, this attachment need being satisfied through addictive processes.
Yeah, and here's a great example of the curating, because we've got this wonderful stuff on this trauma, addiction, attachment is a major issue. And we've had sort of sitting a little bit for a couple of months, just waiting for a right space from Helen Maxfield, one of our good friends, who wrote a piece on looking at the nature of attachment, at giving a discussion, utilizing and bringing in some fabulous references and other people's thinkings and thoughts as she goes, as going down, giving us a view, another view. So we've got that view of Oliver Morgan's, and I wanted to have a balance. I wanted to have a second view that was looking.
Yes, yeah.
But the other thing that I really liked, do you want to say something about what Helen's done?
No, I was just saying, Helen is a wonderful, she's a poet, she's a wordsmith, and she has this wonderful right brain approach to things. And so I was just going to add, you know, it's nice to have that aspect too.
Yeah, no, it's really, because that's what I was going to leap onto, was what caught my eye and what took me a little while just to figure out exactly the right place for it, was she gets into a poetic. She talks about the nature of being inspired, of how poetry, how prose, how story can lead us to deeper understandings. And then I remembered this lovely piece that was sent to me by Lynn Hinderaker from the States. And he's a coach, a motivator, and he likes to write in story things that have messages and have some kind of way of tripping ourselves, a bit sort of Ericksonian, sort of shifting ourselves through surprise and wonder. So it's a fabulous story. You just have to read the story, because it gives its own story as it comes through. So that was Helen's. So that was, you know, Oliver's that stimulated Helen's, which brought in Lynn's. And I think there's another author we've put in there, isn't there?
No, I think there's this guy called Richard Hill, and he threw a few things in there as well.
I wrote lots of stories when I was trying to deal with the suicide loss that we had in the family. And I wrote lots of stories, and I found that I was looking for what was of value, what was of meaning. Right. So we've got a couple of those in there where they're my little parables, I suppose. And I think that they balance out very nicely. So there's a lot of stuff.
There is a lot of stuff
going on in there.
There is. Wonderful. So get into that. That is out right now, and I'll leave a link in the show notes so you can go straight to that issue of the Science of Psychotherapy magazine.
And I just want to take a second just to add a little bit more, just a couple of minutes more if everyone's got a bit of time. Because one of the things that I wrote and sometimes I'm writing these editorials in a fairly rushed sort of way, but I'm just waiting for some kind of thought to come through, and then I wrote it. And I was looking at actually the Facebook feed, my Facebook feed, and there was just, I would have had a dozen different bits of information, different bits of research, different opinions, some YouTube videos, some TED Talks. And I just thought, how on earth, what is this all about? And so I wrote in the editorial that we look for things that are interesting, and we look for things that are of value. And the key of those two statements or really questions is that they're quite different.
Okay.
Because you could be interested in everything to some degree. Everything can be interesting. Mm. Doesn't necessarily mean it's interesting that you like it, you know, good things, bad things, whatever. Mm-hmm. But what's really important is what you value.
Right.
And valuing is, and I hope I'm not sort of extending the sort of the thoughts too much or being drawing too long a bow. But when you value something, you look at it, it's interesting. That's good. We can all do that. And I go, but this means something to me. This is valuable to me. It mm-hmm. triggers, it resonates. There's lots of other terms we use. And this is kind of a relational experience with the information. And as I looked down all these various things were coming through, I was interested in all of them, but I only really went to look at a couple of them. And I found that a very valuable thing to put in, even our knowledge framework, we can look upon as having relational importance.
I think this is one of the difficulties when it comes to curating news items, because there is just so much out there, and what is meaningful to us is at, you know, a personal level. And so what do we serve up our community that is going to be meaningful, not just interesting? And that is a difficulty. Would you agree?
Yeah. I wrote down two areas. We have a situation of information that comes to us, and it gives us we have some rapport with it. We have some sense of belief in it. It's intuitively satisfying.
Right.
Then we have this other term of counterintuitive, that we read something, some evidence, some research, and we go, that's really weird. I wouldn't have thought that. It did remind me of the quote from Steven Pinker, who said, it's funny, the more I know, the less things are counterintuitive, which was quite interesting. But then I thought that there's also another aspect that comes through as we look at the value of something. And is the value of it is that it confirms what we think or feel or believe. But equally, I think it is a value when something disconfirms what right. we go. We go, well, certainly if you're scientific and, you know, mm-hmm. and you like, mm-hmm. you believe in facts being changeable and that everything's a new investigation. And then sometimes it gets really exciting and you get new knowledge. I mean, right. like when mirror neurons came along and when we started to discover brain plasticity, well, even though that's back in the 60s with Marion Diamond, or when suddenly the memory reconsolidation, we said, oh, wow, you know. So sometimes there's brand new knowledge that's neither intuitive nor counterintuitive nor confirming nor disconfirming, just expansive and possible. And mm-hmm. this is why, you know, I preach curiosity, you know, that but it's curiosity for meaning. Just needs to right. mean something right. to me.
So, Richard, I've been thinking about the new research that I get maybe a dozen, two dozen pieces of new research coming across my desk every single day. You know, I have these feeds that come in. It's an overwhelming number of, bits of research. We used to every day, you know, put a number of these out to our community. And I think one of the errors there was we're just overwhelming people with too much information. So we sort of pulled back from that. But now, you know, I'm thinking, let's bring some of that back into conversation. And I'm wondering if it's going to be beneficial for our community if we, you know, maybe once a week we pick one or two really interesting bits of new research that we feel has value to our community.
Yeah.
And we throw it around and we discuss it.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, and you're being very sort of circumspect about it. I think that's like a fantastic idea. I think maybe you're talking me into it, but to do more podcasts. But we could do that. I mean, maybe, you know. I mean, it doesn't matter if we do it every week. But when we get a couple of pieces, and yeah, this thing of let's just have a chat about this not only for its information, but for what it potentially means to people. Not as these big banner things. I keep seeing this. There was one I saw. It was great. The banner with headline was that abused and neglected children are 4 times more likely to develop serious mental illness.
Well, right.
Kind of like, great, good to see the research, but duh. That's not a surprise. That's interesting. I would rather the headline have said, we have found, as many of us have thought and based on previous research, that this is actually a true thing. So we can have more confidence in that. But you don't sell things take the hype out.
Exactly.
And so, put in the meaning and discussion.
Exactly. So there's marketing hype when it comes to some of these headlines, and they do make out that this is something, you know, new, and it sort of catches the reader's eye. But they are things that you intuitively we've known for a long time. But because of the nature of the scientific method, we, even though we have an intuition about it, or we know that that's the truth, it still has to go through proving through the scientific method.
Yeah, and we can discuss the value of these things. All right. I'd love to do it. Let's put that on the agenda. And ladies and gentlemen,
do you want to talk about a few now? Are there some things that have come up that you want to talk about now?
Well, I think there's one that was interesting me very much that I saw, and it's from the Journal of Neuroscience, and the headline is "The Molecular Link Between Chronic Pain and Depression," mm-hmm. which I think is something that intuitively sits with me, and it confirms some of the thoughts and works I've been doing. Now, it's talking about that the activity that pain produces and the chemicals that are produced in the bed nucleus of the stria terminalis, in the dorsal aspect of that, interrupts and affects the production of dopamine from the ventral tegmental area. And so what you get is a mesolimbic dopamine system, because remember there's four systems. Go and check out the dangers of dopamine. So that's that limbic area which gives us rises and fall in affective state, as mm-hmm. different from the basal ganglia one, where we get rises and falls in movement states. Pain, there we've seen the connection. Now, intuitively, I think we know that pain makes us feel depressed, gives us a feeling of depressed. And it confirms a sense of the knowledge, but it shifts our depth of perception of its mental processes. That actually, when we're talking about it, what I'd like to do is continue looking at the research. Are we talking about just the stimulation that we get of pain, mm-hmm. that coming from the peripheral nervous system, or are mm-hmm. we also talking about the attitude towards pain, the feeling of pain, as Damasio would say it, which is something that's based on our negative biases and various other memories and processes.
The interpretation of the pain.
The interpretation. Mm. So does that too also impact our dopamine areas? And does that pain, because of that, have other implications? This, I think, is a door opener.
Okay.
Now, when we talk about, so what's the value of this? It's interesting. I can see it tells me specific details about processes of chronic disturbance and dopamine production.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a door opener. And it's a door opener towards somewhere where I say, I don't know enough about this.
Mm-hmm.
But I am now got a firmer sense, because it intuitively satisfies me, a confirming impression of, yes, pain also affects our affective state. And then I start thinking about lots of things in relation to pain through separation, Lieberman's work with Eisenberg. Suddenly I've got all these exciting things going on. And
okay,
that's the value for me.
Okay, wonderful. Well, give us a link to that study. We'll point people to that one. So I've got an interesting one here that has come out recently, and it's how do people with a psychopathic trait control dark impulses? And so this was a study that was done about how do people with these psychopathic tendencies, how do they control some of their, you know, the darker side so that they can, well, basically stay out of jail. there's about 1% of the population that have these psychopathic traits, and yet our jails are filled with somewhere between 15 and 25% of people with psychopathic traits. But there's some successful people with psychopathic traits that are able to control the darker side, so to speak. And so these researchers were looking at what is going on in the brains of these people that are, allow them to be successful, that they can stay in relationships, they can keep their jobs, they can stay out of jail. And so they did these studies where they were doing MRIs of these individuals, and they found that the ventrolateral prefrontal cortex, so that's the on the sides of the prefrontal cortex, which has to do with self-regulation processes, was actually more dense neural architecture in those areas than those that weren't so successful at controlling the darker side of their psychopathic traits. So there's something going on there about having a more robust or active ventrolateral prefrontal cortex that allows people with psychopathic traits to keep their darker side, you know, under control and keep themselves out of trouble.
Yeah, or, of course, ipso facto the other way, of those that work hard at controlling and maintaining a socially acceptable behaviour will develop a more dense aspect.
Yeah. So that's a very good point. So in a lot of these studies that we read about, you know, which is the horse and which is the cart when it comes to... Like you said, through, you know, hard work in controlling impulses, do we develop that ventrolateral prefrontal cortex, or is it a natural part of their biology that those areas are denser?
And of course, in the context of complex systems, it's entirely likely that it's a combination of both. That for some people, it's easier for density to be created when they do activity. So again, we've opened up. I don't know, is this what makes things of value, where they give us a sense of stepping forward but continue to open doors of possibility?
So the thing that immediately comes to mind is if you have a client with psychopathic tendencies and you know that, you know, the ventrolateral prefrontal cortex is key for them to be able to control their impulses, what sort of things can we do to develop that area, that brain region?
I'm thinking of A Beautiful Mind. Russell Crowe did so beautifully, where eventually he learnt to contain and maintain his own mental state with the schizophrenia. Even though that beautiful scene where the guy from the Nobel Prize says, "You know, you won the Nobel Prize," and he turns to a student and says, "Is this bloke actually here?" I thought it was quite interesting. Quite funny, but we have to be mindful that this isn't the be all and end all, which I think is what we're getting at. That science research and things brings up specific elements, and the science of psychotherapy preaches much more the nature of systems, complex systems. Mm-hmm. So every time we find some element that's interesting, that's not the answer. That's not the end of the story.
No, of course.
How else does it play out? And I'll be really interested to look at what other research comes up with other brain areas. And then suddenly, and maybe there's someone doing connectome stuff. So again, I'm getting excited about where we go with this next.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
Okay. So I think it's going to be of value to go through some studies like this, Richard, and we'll spend a bit of time and sort of chew them over and see, you know, what is of value here.
Yeah. Yeah, we didn't. This one was we weren't planning to do the depth one day, so we didn't look in depth. But I've learned some stuff, and that's pretty cool.
All right. Well, we'll actually look at something in depth and do a bit of research and be able to bring something, you know, of real value to the community. One of the things I do notice is, because these things are, you know, like I said, they're coming across my desk all the time. And I think we have to be mindful, well, first of all, of that, you know, sensationalism that seems to happen, you know, with the publishing of these studies. But also there are a lot of these studies that are done, especially psychological studies, they're done with, you know, the undergraduate Psych 101 students. And so I think someone has said before, you know, we know more about the psychology of, you know, Psych 101 students in universities than any other population on the planet. So we will talk about this as well and have a look at what are the populations that these studies are being done on.
Yeah, it's relevant. As we've seen lately, you know, is it balanced? Is it male? Is it largely male, largely female? I mean, we're getting more balanced now, but for a long time, we only ever investigated males. And then suddenly we read this fascinating study and we find it's with rats, which is interesting, but maybe that's got a little bit of a ways to go. The joy of knowledge is where it enables us to go next, where it stops us and means we can just say, well, I know it now. We'll do a bit more of that. And
let me just ask the community too. Look, if there's interesting studies that you're aware of that you'd like us to look into, to talk about, just write in and let us know.
You know, and if you have an opinion about it, you know, give us a few paragraphs and we'll read it out and take that as our discussion point.
Yeah, absolutely.
We're a community, even though Matt and I seem to hog the airwaves.
We do, but we're very happy to share it as well.
really keen to. Okay. Yeah. Okay. I think that's all we can do for now, because actually I've got a client coming. See?
Okay.
We actually see clients. We don't just sit here rabbiting on the radio day in, day out.
We do.
Although it would be fun.
Okay. Thanks so much, Richard. And thank you, everyone, for joining us here on the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. And we will catch you next week.
Yes, with a fabulous guest. You've had enough of us. Well, bye for now.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. For more great science, go to thescienceofpsychotherapy.com.